everyone. Thank you for sticking it out here on the last day of the conference in conjunction with the Giants parade. I'm a diehard Red Sox fan, so I could care less about the parade because we didn't show up this year. I have no financial disclosures to reveal at this point. And it's my honor to be here today. And if anybody needs to stand up, stretch your legs, please feel free. It's been a long session. It's my honor to be here today on behalf of the Committee to Accelerate Progress in Obesity Prevention from the Institute of Medicine to tell you a little bit about our report. In the back, I think there might still be some copies of some flyers that I left out there that summarize all the recommendations in the report and give you more information on where you can get a full copy of the report. So those are back there. There might still be some fact sheets or flyers as well that are sort of more like takeaway messages for individual sectors that I'm going to talk about. So the Committee on Accelerating Progress in Obesity Prevention was charged with a small task of reviewing all past obesity prevention-related recommendations. I mean all. identifying a set of critical recommendations for future action and recommending indicators of progress in implementing these actions. So we have a tiny little task associated with our work. We have a very interesting and illustrious committee. The chair of the committee was Dan Glickman, who's the former Secretary of Agriculture and former U.S. Senator as well. Marcy Greenwood, who's the vice chair of the University of Hawaii Health System, or she's the president of the University of Hawaii Health System, and she was one of our vice chairs. And Bill Purcell, who's the former mayor of Nashville, was also a vice chair. Here in California, Pat Crawford was on the committee, as well as Tony Eaton from the California Endowment. So it's really a very prolific and very impressive group to work with. So our focus was really, and I'm not going to also review all the data about obesity. We all know the problem at this point, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to skip right to the punchline here. So as I said, we had a small task. We reviewed about 800-plus obesity prevention-related recommendations from pretty much every source we could find. Prior IOM reports, Healthy Eating Active Living Convergence Partnership, CHHS materials from CDC, the Community Preventive Services Task Force, the Keystone Forum, the White House Task Force, the NGA, NACHO, NACHO, the National Physical Activity Plan, NALBO, RWJ, Trust for America's Health, USDA, you name it, we reviewed it. and we really identified five key goals that overlap quite a bit, actually, Michelle, with the goal areas that you had in your presentation for California. The first one was to integrate physical activity every day in every way and make healthy foods available everywhere. Third one was really focused on marketing. What matters for a healthy life. The fifth one was to activate employers and healthcare professionals. And the fifth, but not least, was to strengthen schools as the heart of health. What the committee firmly believed was that if we simultaneously addressed all five of these areas in conjunction with one another, then we would be positioned to accelerate progress in obesity prevention. Basically, we felt that on their own, any one of these five solutions might help speed up progress, but it's the collective combination of their combined effect that would really do the most to reinforce, amplify, and maximize our efforts to accelerate progress in obesity prevention. I was in a session yesterday where one of my colleagues was presenting on a school food paper. And there's a question from the audience about, you know, why do we care about schools if we know that a lot of the competitive food policies are making changes in schools and having a positive effect on schools but not reducing overall consumption outside of schools? Why do we care about schools? If we don't deal with schools and we don't deal with everything else, then it's not going to matter, period. So schools are a critical part of the puzzle, but they're not the only part. And a lot of focus so far has been on the school environment only. And the committee felt very strongly that it's going to require concerted effort on all sectors of society, not just decision makers and policy makers, not just governments, not just schools, but healthcare sector, insurers, transportation, urban planning, you name it. Everybody has a role to play. And let me not forget, industry. So I will get to those sectors in a minute. So what were our recommendation strategies and action steps? The first one was about physical activity. Basically, the goal is make physical activity available every day in every way. We know that most Americans don't get the recommended daily 60 minutes of physical activity every day. In fact, only about 19% of all Americans get that amount of physical activity. So we felt very strongly that we really need to make physical activity a focal point. A lot of the prior reports usually start with the food environment or they start with schools. Physical activity often has been one of the later elements. And we felt very strongly we need to say flat out, we've got to figure out ways throughout society to make physical activity available every day in every way for every person. And that's no easy task, particularly in certain areas of this country. How do we suggest doing that? We identified four strategies here. The first one was to enhance the physical and built environment. Basically, provide opportunities for people to get physical activity. Okay, there are lots of ways to do it. Some of them absolutely require infrastructure changes, and we realize that. But some of them don't necessarily require infrastructure changes. It requires partnerships and collaboration, such as those described with CLOC and what California is doing and other groups are doing. The second strategy is to provide and support community programs designed to increase physical activity. There are lots of ways to do that. There's a lot of movement afoot about these joint and shared and community use programs. And those are great. And it's great to have a joint use agreement or a shared use agreement. But unless you can actually get people there, unless you actually fully open up access to all the facilities, the running tracks, things like that, those joint use agreements aren't going to do a whole lot. So we need to make sure that the joint use agreements are in place, but we also need to make sure that there are plenty of program opportunities for people to actually get their physical activity. It's more than just having an MOU. We need to, third strategy here built off of a prior IOM report on early child care settings, where we recommended adopting physical activity requirements for licensed child care providers. Okay, most licensed child care providers in this country do not have physical activity recommendations or requirements. You know, a lot of them have minimal food requirements, but very few actually have physical activity provisions in place for licensed child care or early child care settings. So we really need to come up with national standards in this area. Of course, licensed child care is not the rubric of the federal government. It's a state-based thing and a local thing, and so it's critical for states and other decision makers at the local levels to really play an active role in ensuring that as part of the licensing process, the physical activity is incorporated into the requirements for early child care providers. The fourth strategy actually relates to the National Physical Activity Guidelines, or the Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans, excuse me. Those Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans were developed in 2008, and there's no requirement in place to systematically update them every 5 years like we have for the Dietary Guidelines. So the committee felt very strongly that we really need to put the Physical Activity Guidelines on the same schedule as the Dietary Guidelines, enable us to review the science every 5 years like we do with the Dietary Guidelines, and ensure that the Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans are the most recent and up-to-date and based on the latest available science like the Dietary Guidelines. The second recommendation focuses on the food and beverage environment. Okay, make the healthy choice the easy, affordable, and accessible option. Okay, we know that Americans, caloric intake and consumption has increased substantially in recent decades. Portion sizes have gone up. We know about all this. So what are we going to do about this? What are our recommendations? We have five recommendations here. The first one specifically focused on a specific beverage category. It's the only area where we focused in on a specific category. And here we focused on reducing overconsumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. We did that specifically because sugar-sweetened beverages are the largest source of added sugars in the American diet. And we felt strongly that if we could at least start to move the dial on sugar-sweetened beverage consumption, then Americans' consumption of solid fats and added sugars would start to go down. We have a really interesting graphic in the report that kind of shows you how much additional solid fats and added sugars Americans are consuming on a daily basis over and above what the Dietary Guidelines recommend. If every American cut out one soda a day or one sugar-sweetened beverage a day, it would go a long way towards getting people towards the recommended daily caloric intake for their age and gender. The second how are we going to reduce overconsumption of sugar-sweetened beverages? We have a number of strategies in there. This is one area where we had something identified for every sector you can imagine, okay? So we recommended making non-sugar-sweetened beverage or healthier options available in all places. That would be public work sites, private work sites, child care centers, the home, parks and recreation, schools, you name it. Make the healthy beverage options widely available, okay? And price them competitively so that they are priced at the same price as sugar-sweetened beverages. The committee was not going to come out and say ban sugar-sweetened beverages. That's not what we were doing. We need to reduce overconsumption. The way to do that is, you know, through a large-scale marketing campaign. Basically, you reduce the price of the healthier options, you make them accessible, you make them widely available, and you give people an incentive to access them. So make the waters and things, 100% juices and things like that readily available for people in all places in every way. That would include recreation facilities such as movie theaters. Okay, some movie theaters have gone towards making more healthy options available. Dan Glickman was the chair of the committee. He actually is a former head of the Motion Picture Association of America. So every single meeting when we were talking about this particular recommendation, we talked about movie theaters as one prime example of a recreational place where people actually take in a lot of calories at movies. Between the popcorn, the candy, and the sugar-sweetened beverage, they take in a lot. in one sitting, and so what are ways we can do this and make this applicable for everyone? On the industry side of things, the committee recommended ways for the industry to play a role here, including reducing portion sizes, increasing distribution and availability of other options such as waters and things like that. Also, reducing sugar content in beverages. Of course, they're not going to, you know, jump on that one without focus group testing and making sure that it's still palatable to the American consumer. But we did try and find roles for the industry to play here too, because it's definitely going to take a partnership. It's not something that public health, for example, can do alone. We did have one recommendation in there related to governments can implement fiscal policies, as can the private sector, implement fiscal policies and strategies as ways to incentivize healthier options or disincentivize the sugar-sweetened beverage option. Moving on to some of the other strategies, the second one focused on increasing the availability of lower-calorie and healthier food and beverage options for children in restaurants. Okay, changing the default option so it's no longer the unhealthy option. Change the default option for kids' menus so it has a wide variety of healthy options available, both in terms of foods and beverages. I had the opportunity, the pleasure recently, of taking my 11-year-old son to a restaurant where on their kids' menu, they had a grilled chicken, they had a grilled salmon, and they had a vegetarian dish. And those were the only three options available to kids. And I was so excited. I'm like, I wish all restaurants would do that. Of course, not all kids would eat those three options, but my son being a foodie, he was welcome to it. But it would be really nice to see a movement afoot to start to move towards more healthier options for our kids so that what they recognize as being the default option is the healthier option. Strategy three was to use nutritional standards for all foods and beverages sold or provided through the government. So these would include through procurement opportunities, through meetings, work sites, things like that, and places frequented by the public. Strategy four, big issue for Tony Eaton and the California Endowment and many other communities across the country, really use financial incentives and zoning strategies to improve the local food environment, start to tick away at the food deserts, providing incentive to stores who are committing to healthy food promotion and healthy food access. And then finally, we often got asked the question in our public comment periods about what are we going to recommend related to U.S. agriculture policy and the subsidy program. We were not in a position to say anything about that definitively because there's actually not much science behind the comments relative to, thank you, the science that we were given relative to the direct linkage between the subsidy program and obesity directly. There's lots of information out there, but we didn't have enough evidence to be able to come out and say definitively, you've got to change the subsidy program. So what the committee recommended was to conduct studies to examine the effects of U.S. agriculture policy on diet and obesity. Message environment is critical. We need to change the messaging that all of us see on a daily basis. Kids in particular spend so much time in sedentary behaviors in front of televisions and internet and things like that. We need to transform our message environment related to not just the food environment, but also the physical activity environment. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go through these pretty quick. But we had several recommendations for sustained nationwide campaigns and social marketing programs, many of which perhaps could be run out of CDC's marketing or communications program and center. Implementing common standards for marketing food and beverages to children and adolescents. We know that there's a CFBAI initiative, which is a voluntary-based initiative on the part of industry and restaurants and food providers. The committee felt that if within the next 2 years, the vast majority of the food and beverage industry don't sign on to that and don't start participating in it, that we recommend that the federal government step in and develop nationwide standards for marketing of food and beverages to children and adolescents. Strategy 3 built specifically off the IOM reports related to food marketing and food nutrition labeling on front of packs. And then finally, adopting consistent nutrition education policies for all federal programs with nutrition education programs so that it includes not just SNAP-Ed, WIC, other programs like it that have any sort of educational component associated with them. We absolutely saw a role for healthcare insurers and employers to play here. It can't just be about the kids. We can't just change the food and beverage environments, but we need to make sure that our healthcare providers are screening people, not just for obesity and overweight, but screening people for the risk factors associated with obesity and overweight and their daily practices. What's your food intake like? What's your beverage intake like? You know, doctors ask about cigarette consumption and drug use. They need to start asking about how many sugar-sweetened beverages do you have on a daily basis? How much, high-fat foods do you take in on a daily basis? Make that a routine part of the screening process and making sure that insurers also are providing coverage, access, and screening incentives for routine obesity prevention, screening, diagnosis, and treatment. Employers absolutely have a role to play here by encouraging and providing opportunities. Opportunities is the key here. Provide opportunities for people to be active at their workplace, as well as have an opportunity to have a healthy meal or eat healthy snacks at the workplace. You know, many of us have vending machines in our workplaces. Some of us may have cafeterias in our workplaces. You know, what can we do to ensure that those sites have healthy options available that are competitively priced, that are affordably priced, and in the ideal world, they're priced cheaper than the unhealthy options. We know that may not be realistic, but we can obviously shoot for the goal. And then last but not least, certainly, make breastfeeding facilities widely available in workplace environments and other public places. Schools was our fifth recommendation. We saw schools as the heart of health, central to pretty much everything else, as I mentioned early on. But as I also mentioned early on, schools cannot do this alone. We all know that there have been a lot of movement afoot at the federal level, at the state level, at the local school district levels to change school food and physical activity environments, and it's fantastic. And that work needs to still continue, but it can't be done in a vacuum. It's got to be done in conjunction with all these other changes. We recommended some of the same things that all the other groups out there recommend. Require quality PE and opportunities for PA in schools. That's the hardest one of these to do because it involves time and competing demands. Ensure strong nutritional standards for all foods and beverages sold or provided through schools. That one's a little bit, USDA, with the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, was first time given the authority to regulate the competitive food environment in schools. As the first speaker mentioned, USDA is way behind on issuing those regulations. They certainly won't be issuing them before Tuesday, November 6th, but hopefully shortly thereafter, the proposed rule will be issued, and we all will have a wonderful opportunity to provide public comment at that point. And I would imagine in the next couple of years, hopefully, we will have nationwide competitive food standards. But it's important to note, those are not going to be preemptive. So states and local districts will still have a key role to play in regulating the competitive food environment. And then food literacy, of course, is equally important. I'm out of time here, but I just want to bring your attention for those of you researchers in the room who are interested in systems design and systems thinking. We sort of saw all this linked together in sort of the spaghetti systems map. Appendix B of the full report is all about the systems design and recommendations we have for going beyond the socio-ecological model. We really need to start focusing in on the interconnectedness of all the recommendations and how they link together and how they could work together to really change our obesogenic environments and our food and physical activity environments. And this is just a simple diagram of that earlier scheme that I represented. It really kind of shows you how all the areas interact. And then finally, I don't want to leave out the part that we really felt that we need to do everything we can to help to achieve equity. There's a whole discussion in the full report on it. I'm out of time, and I did not mean to give the short shrift in any way, shape, or form. But we really need to make efforts to transform inequitable environments in all areas. Food and beverage, physical activity is often a forgotten one, and the messaging in particular. And we need to target critical settings, not just schools, as I said, but work sites and everywhere we live, work, and play. So it's going to take your engagement and leadership, and it's going to take us all. Thank you very much. And these are copies of the reports. You can go on iom.edu to get full copies of the reports. They're available for free for download.
At this time, we'll welcome the presenters up to the panel for questions. To summarize, we've heard a lot of different entities at the local level, for instance, Chicago, at the state level, California, and the federal level, CDC and the Institute of Medicine, use a number of different models to address the obesity epidemic. Common themes that we heard were stakeholder involvement, collaborations, a participatory approach to PSE change. We also heard that research based on evidence and literature is needed using the socio-ecological model or a systems approach. And lastly, we heard about systematic processes to plan, implement, or evaluate initiatives to accelerate the obesity prevention agenda. So at this time, we'll open the floor for questions. Sir?
The question is actually for you. In terms of USDA and rules coming out, what do you anticipate would likely happen in the event that there is a change?
Am I being taped? I anticipate if there's a change in the administration, those rules will not go forward. So it's going to be continue to be a patchwork approach at the state and district levels. I can tell you that those rules, if they do go forward, all that Congress required with the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act is that the rules be aligned and consistent with the dietary guidelines. So I don't expect them to be overly prescriptive. Just based on what happened with the school meal regulations and things like that, I think there's still going to be a lot of leeway for the states and districts to do things a lot stronger. Connecticut's a really good example. They have some really strong standards in Connecticut, and they'll still be able to implement their strong standards, California, too. So.
I think I can follow up. Given the tenor
so there's no provision in Healthy Hunger Free Kids that the national standards would preempt in any way. So the national standards, even if they went forward, would still allow for state and local innovation and flexibility. What I would see happening if the current administration did not stay in office is that that authority would just be even bolstered further. They'd be pretty much say it's not the federal role to be telling our schools and our kids and families what they should be eating. If the states want to provide that guidance, fine, but I anticipate that the federal government would have a different stance.
Any other questions? Ma'am?
Right, that's an excellent question. Like Stephen mentioned briefly, this was for our funded state departments that are already, for the most part, engaged some way. So we wanted to provide some guidance to help them from where they were. We weren't asking them to start from scratch, although some may be related to physical activity, nutrition, and obesity. But many are currently in the fifth year of their five-year cooperative agreement. So we wanted to get this guidance out to help them with initiatives they've already started, they're already implementing, but how to provide a health equity lens to some of the work, some of the partnerships, some of the ways they're collecting their data as they continue. Now, moving into the next FOA and given the IOM guidance, that is something that we are considering, how best to provide guidance and what exactly to ask them to do in the next round of their funding cycle. So that's something that's still being worked out.
Dr. Shrieky, did you have anything to add?
So for the IOM report itself, we weren't able to calculate that. There's a new committee that's been formed that I'm actually part of, Committee to Evaluate Progress in Obesity Prevention. And part of the goal of that committee is to develop evaluation plans for how are we going to evaluate implementation of all these strategies nationwide and at the community level and things like that. Part of what hopefully will come out of that will be a way to possibly start to measure the collective impact of these things on obesity. We just aren't there yet.
Well, we're at noon, so if you have additional questions, the presenters will stay for a few minutes. And I'd like to thank the presenters for your presentations and have a safe travel home. Thank you.